Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So I'm in my dorm room as a senior in college, and I hear the phone ring. So I walk across the dorm room to pick up the phone, answer the phone. It's a woman's voice. And there are only two words of this whole conversation that really matter. And those two words were, "I'm pregnant." I was completely stupefied and shocked. And this was totally unexpected news. I wasn't, had no future plans set yet. I didn't have a job. I think I had probably $50 in my bank account. And so I didn't know what to do, but one thing that makes me feel better is running. So I put on my running shoes and went out into the cold Boston night, and I screamed at the sky. But you can't run away from your problems forever. So once I calmed down a little bit, I entered stage two of my response, and that was to pout. So I pouted through the early, you know, Lamaze classes and all that. And then I got a summer job painting houses. I was up on the, you know, ladder painting houses. And I got an email from my college roommate, and he said, you know, "How's the summer going?" And I said, "Well, you know, last summer I was taking a class at the university writing short stories, and this summer I'm painting." And my roommate wrote back to me and said, "Well, I'm really glad that you're expressing your artistic side. This is really beautiful that you're, you know." And so I wrote back to him and said, "Yes, I am. This is a domestic scene, bichromatic, very large surfaces," and he got the idea. Sorry to tell you, I even pouted when my wife went into labor. So I'm just, here's some free advice for the young men here. Do not tell your wife when she's in labor, get a hold of yourself. This is a terrible idea. So my wife's in labor, and they have her hooked up to this fetal heart monitor, and everything's going along fine. Then all of a sudden, the fetal pulse starts to drop. And we kind of notice this, and then it drops more. And we kind of are looking at each other, and then it flatlines. And when it flatlines, this alarm goes off. And all of a sudden, all these medical personnel rush into the room. And they're yelling out orders and prep her for a C-section and get this room ready. And it's utter chaos. I am completely overwhelmed because that room now has about 10 people and are rushing around. And they wheel her down the hall, and they say to me, "Get on a mask." And so I go down the hall, and the doctor gets her ready for the C-section, gets out a knife, and the doctor is getting ready to cut her open to hopefully save the baby. And I thought maybe even she would die. And it wasn't until that moment that I really realized how devastated I would be if that baby were to die, and if she were to die, my wife. Until that moment, I really thought of this child like a little vampire that was going to suck the life out of me and make me into a kind of duty-deadened adult. So the surgeon's about to cut her open, and suddenly the fetal heart rate comes back. It comes back more, and puts down the scalpel. It comes back more. And then about 15 minutes later, my daughter, Elizabeth Ann, was born. And because the labor went so quick, she looked just perfect. She didn't have a cone head the way some babies do. She looked just absolutely beautiful. And I was so relieved and so overwhelmed with joy that both of them weren't dead, that it was literally the best day of my entire life. I've never been so happy before. The next day when I woke up, my face was sore because I've been smiling so much and so full of joy. Now, why am I talking to you about my daughter? Well, my daughter's conception is not unusual. In fact, about the same time, I talked to two of my friends from college, both of whom got their girlfriends pregnant, and both of whom got their girlfriends to get abortions. So, unfortunately, this is a very common situation. And I'd like to talk to you today about four questions that I think are really key to thinking about this issue clearly. And those four questions are, is this individual alive? Secondly, is this individual human? Thirdly, is it right and just to kill this individual? And finally, don't women have a right to control their bodies such that even if it's true that this individual is human and alive and ought not to be killed, still the right to control your body overwhelms those other considerations. So first, let's start off with this idea of, is this individual alive? If you were to try to figure out whether any particular individual is alive, there are some pretty standard biological tests you can use. But perhaps the most intuitively obvious is this. Anything that can die has to first be alive. And when you think about it that way, it's completely obvious that the human being in utero is a living thing. Because everyone recognizes, and it happens all the time, that there are miscarriages, and the human being in utero dies before being born. The human being in utero is growing proportionately, assimilating nutrition, maintaining homeostasis. All of these are characteristics of living things, not non-living things. And likewise, if you take a scientific perspective, it becomes crystal clear that the individual who's living is also a human individual. If you took a skin sample, if you took a blood sample, if you were to test the DNA, all of these would come back with human skin, human blood, human DNA, as opposed to canine DNA or a dolphin's DNA. In fact, it's impossible that you could have a human man and a human woman engage in reproductive activity, and then they reproduce a dog, a cat, a tree, a dolphin, a mouse, or anything else. So all available scientific evidence points to the reality that this individual is not just alive, but also a living human being. So at least among philosophers who have studied this, those two first points are settled. Philosophers don't argue, well, it's not really alive. This is something people on the street sometimes argue, but philosophers don't argue that. And they don't argue about, is this a member of the species Homo sapiens? So philosophers like Peter Singer fully admit both those facts, because those are facts. They're as much facts as any other scientific fact out there. So the real question is about killing. And is this killing justified or not justified? And here we move beyond science, beyond what's empirically verifiable, to ethics, to moral philosophy, to maybe moral theology. But we're out of the realm of just science and facts. We're into the realm of what ought to take place, what should take place. And there's a number of ways to think about this, but one of the most powerful is to start to think with the intuition that it's wrong to kill you and me. If someone were to come into this room right now with a machine gun and start mowing us down and killing us, that person would do something very seriously wrong. Now, what explains that? Well, there's different accounts of why killing is wrong, but here's one account given by the philosopher Don Marquis. So Don Marquis was a philosopher at the University of Kansas, an atheist, and here's his account of why killing you and me is wrong. He says, if you kill you or me, you're not taking away our past. Whatever happened yesterday or a year ago, you know, that happened and we still have that, as it were. But what happens if you kill you or me is you take away our future goods. So if you die today, you're going to miss out on the friends you would have made tomorrow. You'll miss out on the beautiful things like walking around this beautiful campus that hopefully you could do tomorrow. You'll miss out on new knowledge that you could attain. You'll miss out on new relationships that you could attain. So all that is taken away from you if someone kills you today, or if someone kills me today. So what killing does is it takes away our chance for a valuable future. And so Marquis says the very same principle that killing is wrong because it takes away a future of value applies to a newborn baby and also applies to a human being prior to birth. If you kill the newborn baby, well, then that newborn's not going to be able to grow and make friends and see beautiful things and have friendships and have relationships and learn new things. All that's going to be taken away. And likewise, if you kill the human being prior to birth, all those same factors are in play. So one reason to think that abortion is seriously wrong is that it's seriously wrong for the same reason that killing you or me is seriously wrong. It deprives us of our future of value. A second reason to think that such killing is wrong rests on the idea of human rights. Almost everyone in our culture, if you took a survey out there and you just stopped, 100 random students and said, do you believe in human rights? I bet 99 or even 100 would say, yes, of course I do. And if you said to them, do you believe in human rights in the sense that every single human being deserves respect, that we shouldn't exclude certain people from basic respect based on their religion or based on their disability or based on their race, based on their creed? Again, probably 99 or 100 out of 100 on your campus would say, yes, of course I do. But if you accept that principle, and if you accept the scientific reality that this is a living human being in question, well, then it follows that the human newborn and the human fetus would have the same human rights as you or me or anybody else on campus, because we're all equally human. We may be different ages, we may be different sizes, different religions, different races, but everyone is human, is equally human with everybody else. So a second reason to adopt a pro-life view is based on this principle of universal human rights, that every single human being should have human rights. And again, very, very few people will deny that. Now, what will happen sometimes if you raise this point with someone is they'll say, well, it's not really human. But then you have to go back to what we just talked about. All available scientific evidence points to the fact that this is a member of our species. Just like a fetus in a kitten, well, that would be a feline fetus, right? Not a human fetus. A third reason to think that all human beings, including those who are in utero, deserve basic human rights and basic respect is a lesson drawn from history. So if you study history, you will see many times in human experience where powerful people have divided the human family into two groups. And so sometimes it's white men will say, well, if you're like me, if you're a white man, then you have rights and dignity and you deserve respect. But if you're a black man, well, then you don't. Or if you're a European, then you deserve rights and dignity and respect and the rule of law applies to you. But if you're a native person, an indigenous person, well, it doesn't apply to you. Or if you have my religion, well, then you deserve respect. But if you don't have my religion, you have a different religion, well, then you're not included. But if you think about it, every single time we've ever divided the human family into those that have basic human rights and those that don't, every time we've practiced the ethics of exclusivity, we've always made a terrible error. There's no case that I'm aware of where we look back in history and say, you know, that was a really good move back when, you know, I don't know, all the Catholics didn't have basic rights and the Protestants could just kill them. That was a fantastic time. I mean, no one thinks that. Everyone thinks, oh, that was terrible. So if we're going to learn from history, it seems to me what we have to do is practice the ethics of inclusion. An ethics where every single member of the human family counts as having basic rights. That all human beings, not just some that are like us, not just the powerful, but all human beings deserve basic respect. So you could have somebody who says, look, I agree with what you've said so far. I can see how there's a lot of scientific evidence that this is a living individual, a lot of scientific evidence that this is a human individual, and I can even see how if you think there are basic human rights for all human beings, well, then it would follow that the human fetus and the human newborn have basic human rights. But there's another way to justify abortion that I want to address now, and that is from the bodily autonomy of women who get pregnant. And so the idea would be, yes, you're right that the human fetus has a right to live, but you're wrong that this entails that the person in question has to support this fetus all through 9 months. And as some of you may know, the most famous example of this argument was given by a philosopher named Judith Jarvis Thompson in the early 70s. And what Thompson says is this: imagine that you get kidnapped. And tomorrow morning you wake up after they knock you out, kidnap you, and you wake up tomorrow morning and you're in the hospital. And you look over and right next to you, you're connected to somebody else in the bed next to you. And the doctors come in and they say, well, I'm so sorry that this happened to you, but you know, this famous violinist here needs to be supported for the next 9 months because the famous violinist has this underlying health problem. And so they need to use your bodily organs to continue to survive. So I'm really sorry, but this violinist has a right to life. And so you're going to have to sit in the bed for the next 9 months and support this person. And then after 9 months, she'll be healed and cured and then we can just let her go off on her own, and then you can go off on your own. But for the next 9 months, you're stuck here in bed with the violinist. So this intuition, you might say, or this example, is supported by two other analogies that Thompson puts forward. She says, imagine that someone breaks into your house, a burglar. If the person breaks into your house, you, as the homeowner, have a right to expel the burglar from your house. And if the burglar refuses to leave and just continues to be in your house, you could even use lethal force to expel the burglar from your house. And then finally, she says that pregnancy is a little bit like people seeds. So it's like, you know, people seeds float through the window and get in your carpet and they start to grow in your house. Well, you would have a right, if the people seeds floated in your window, to vacuum it up. And this right doesn't depend on how the people seeds got here. So, for instance, let's say the burglar got into your house because you forgot to lock the door, right? You were in a rush and you just didn't lock the door. Well, you still have a right to kick the burglar out of your house. If you forgot to lock the window, you still have a right to kick the burglar out of your house. And so, yes, maybe it's a bad idea if you want to avoid pregnancy to forget to use contraception, but if you do, it's still your right to control your own body and to expel the fetus from the pregnant person's body with lethal force. So it's my body, therefore it's my choice. That's the argument of Thompson, and is repeated in various forms. One final way it's repeated is the idea that you should not have to be forced to donate a kidney. So imagine that somebody figures out you're a perfect kidney donor for them, and they need your kidney to survive. Well, you have a right to control your own body. And even though it may be true that you might be the only person around who could donate a kidney to this person, you still don't have an obligation to donate your kidney to this person. Okay, so how would I respond to these arguments of Thompson? Well, let's start off maybe with the violinist argument. I think there's a lot of very significant differences between the case of the violinist on the one hand versus the case of abortion on the other hand. One of the most significant differences is, in the case of the violinist, the idea would be if you detach yourself from the violinist is going to die of her own underlying health problems, right? She has bad kidneys or whatever it is, and she's going to die of her own health problems. So in other words, this is a case really not of intentional killing, but rather of letting die. But abortion is not performed by means of simply snipping the umbilical cord that connects the mother and the human being in utero. That's not how abortions are performed. Rather, in the case of abortion, there's actually a direct attack on the body of the human being in utero, or a poisoning of the body of the human being in utero. So if you thought of the violinist case and you said, well, because this violinist is attached to you, that gives you the right to get an axe and like chop up the violinist. I mean, presumably your intuitions would shift there. But there's a second really important difference, and that's in the case of the violinist, the person who's attached to you is not someone that you have a serious obligation to care for. By contrast, in the case of abortion, both the biological mother and the biological father do have serious obligations to care for their own biological children. So imagine if a guy tonight, one of you guys goes out to a bar and you meet the lady of your dreams. And one thing leads to another, and all of a sudden you're in the broom closet, and all of a sudden, you know, a month later she calls you and says, I'm pregnant. And let's say you say to her, what do you mean you're pregnant? How could you get pregnant? You know, I used a condom, and you told me you were on the pill, and I used spermicide jelly, and there was saran wrap in the closet that we were in, and I wrapped it around you, and I wrapped it around me. How could you get pregnant? This is impossible. So, well, I am. Now, even though you tried to prevent pregnancy by five different methods, none of that would alter the legal and also the moral responsibility you would have to support that child for the next 18 years. You would be legally forced, and I think you should morally do much more than simply pay child support, but you'd be forced to support this child until the child turns 18. We recognize that children are incredibly vulnerable and that children have the right to expect help from their own parents in surviving. If I were to help you and pay for your college tuition at Duke, well, that would be very nice of me. It'd be super generous. But it's a totally different thing for me to support my own children and pay for the things that they need when they're minors. That's not going above and beyond the call of duty like I'm a good Samaritan. That's being a basically decent human father. And this is true of all human fathers, and therefore it's also true of human mothers. The violinist is a stranger, a person to whom you don't have special obligations. But in the case of abortion, this is not a stranger. This is your own son or your own daughter. And so you do have special obligations to your own son or your own daughter. Well, what about the claim that the fetus is like a burglar breaking into your house, and therefore you can expel the burglar from your house using lethal force? Well, my understanding of the law is that in some states you can expel people if you find them in your house, and in some states you can't. So I'm not sure what the law is. But it seems that there's an enormous difference between the case of the burglar and the case of the human being in utero. The burglar is entering your house under the burglar's own power. By contrast, the fetus is where the fetus is because of the actions of the mother and the father. They are the ones who are responsible for the fetus being where the fetus is. The burglar is entering with evil intent. The burglar is breaking the law and knowingly doing something wrong. That is not true at all of the human being in utero. They're totally innocent. They're not guilty of doing anything. So imagine a case that's more close. There is a baby who's in your house, who you caused to be in your house, and then you decide at some point, because the baby's crying or something, I don't want this baby in my house, I'm going to use lethal force to eject the baby out of my house and kill the baby. Would everyone say, oh, great, well, the baby's in your house. Super, that's no problem at all. Of course not, that's crazy. Even if the baby wasn't your biological baby, right? If you caused the baby to be in your house, you couldn't just kill the baby because you wanted the baby out of your house. Is abortion correctly likened to the people seeds floating in the window and getting on the carpet and then you can vacuum them up? That analogy also won't work. Because remember, Thompson's trying to claim that her argument for abortion works even if the human fetus is a person. So let's make it not seeds of people. It's not sperm or ova on your carpet. But you have a baby that comes through the window because of whatever is thrown off a trampoline, falls out of the air, who knows? And the baby lands on your bed and then it's on your carpet. Again, no one would even consider that it would be morally permissible to use lethal force to expel the baby from your house. So I think Thompson's analogies are not going to work. What about the final one of the kidney analogy, right? You find out, or someone finds out that you're a perfect kidney donor for them, and they say, hey, I need your kidney to survive, so now you have a duty to give me your kidney. Well, isn't that like abortion? The human being in utero needs the woman's body to continue to survive to viability, and so the idea would be no woman should be forced to use her body in that way. But if we admit that principle, if we admit the principle that bodily integrity should not be violated, it seems to me that principle leads not to an approval of abortion, but rather a condemnation of abortion. Because the human being developing in utero has his or her own bodily integrity, which is completely violated in the course of abortion. DNC abortion, all the different methods used, all of those methods violate the bodily integrity of the human being in utero. Now, there could theoretically be one kind of abortion that wouldn't, but I'll leave that to the side. Normal abortions, most abortions do. So the bottom line is that these arguments from bodily autonomy simply don't work. And they don't work for even a more fundamental principle. And that is that we do not have legally, and nor do we have morally, perfect autonomy over our bodies. We cannot legally or morally do whatever we want whenever we want to with our bodies. If you were to take off all your clothes and walk across campus, you would get arrested. I assume. Maybe not. I haven't been at Duke before, so I'll venture that you'll get arrested. We can't have sex in public. We can't go to the bathroom in public. We can't use our bodies to transport illegal drugs over the border by putting them inside our bodies in bags or whatever. People try to do this. It's illegal. We do not have a right to do whatever we want with our bodies. And the most obvious way that's a limit is that whenever we use our own bodies to harm another person's body, that is morally and legally illegitimate. If anyone knows jiu-jitsu here, you can kill someone by choking them out with your hands. It's not that hard. If you want to learn, I can teach you after the lecture. It's pretty easy. But if I use my body in that way to kill somebody, obviously that is seriously a prima facie wrong. So the limit to bodily autonomy, bodily control, one of the limits is other people's body. And to use your body in such a way that harms other people's body, that is not a legitimate use of your body. But that is exactly what happens in the case of abortion. So, talked about the idea that the human being in question is living, talked about the idea that the human being in question, or that being in question is human, that this individual human being deserves basic human rights and deserves a chance at a future like ours. And I've also talked about a number of arguments that claim to defeat all those arguments by saying, look, we just appeal to the bodily autonomy of the woman, and that's enough to cancel all whatever considerations that are brought forward. But let me conclude with another story. And this is a story that happened when I was about 28 years old. So I was 28 years old, and I'm walking towards this park bench. And I see this woman sitting on the park bench, and I recognize the person from pictures I'd seen of her hair and stuff. So I walk around the side of the park bench, and she stands up, and she hugs me, and she starts to cry. I mean, cry really hard for probably a minute, maybe two and a half minutes. She was like liquid, and I was dry-eyed. And I thought to myself, so this is what it's like to meet your birth mother. We got to know one another over the years, and she invited me into her life. She let me go to family Christmases. I got to meet her kids. I got to meet her husband, celebrate birthdays together. And then when she got cancer for the third time, we both knew it was the final time. So I got to say goodbye to her and thank her for what she did to me. And then after she died, I was very honored to be asked to be one of three people to give a eulogy at her funeral, along with her son and her daughter. And so I want to end just by what I said at her funeral. What makes a person great? Is it intelligence? She had that. Is it good looks? She had that too. Is it maybe a successful career or a marriage that lasts more than 50 years? Or lifelong friends? And she had all that. But I think what really makes a person good, what really makes a person great, is sacrificial love. Love not of dreams, but of deeds. A love that puts aside one's own plans to help someone else. And that's what Oma had for me. She gave to me, in a way, every good thing in my life. Every single good thing in my life she made possible. Every good thing in the lives of my children she made possible. And so there's no way I could ever repay what she did for me other than to try to live my life in such a way to make her sacrifice worthwhile. And so I hope to see her one day again in that place where joy is made perfect, where sacrificial love receives its reward, and where every tear is wiped away. But for now, it's my turn to cry. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.